Hello and welcome to the CACEIS Climate Briefing Podcast. This is Episode 5, Stewardship. I'm Pat Sharman, Managing Director for CACEIS in the UK. Our aim in this series of podcasts has been to address the reality of climate change and how we move forward.
The climate stability of the past 12,000 years has come to an end. And around the world, we are now suffering from the impact.
So far, we've discussed issues and how to assess what good looks like and how to use data effectively, as well as assessing climate risk.
I think in this day and age where we are in an age of smartphones and extreme terabytes and multibytes of data beyond, I think having a clear data strategy for any firm and any business is pretty crucial.
There's issues which we as investors can engage with companies about. Everybody's got a challenge of sort of dual objectives that we're trying to achieve. And that all goes away if you have clear and decisive policy making.
But for this episode, we'll look at how trustees can make the most of their influence to push for change.
We are at like minute one of day one of year one.
That's Andrew M. Isaacs, a senior lecturer at Berkeley and a director of new management of technology programs.
Large corporations to really get their hands around what climate change means in terms of risk to the business and also in terms of opportunity.
And big companies are beginning to wake up.
In February, we launched a new ambition for BP, to be a net zero company by 2050 or sooner.
ExxonMobil is introducing a carbon capture and storage concept so big, it's like removing 20 million cars off the road.
Shell is becoming an energy business for the future, and it's playing its part to help drive that change.
Within this episode, we'll also explore the somewhat counterintuitive idea that pension schemes can do more for the environment by investing in high carbon sectors. So joining me today in episode 5, around the table is David Neal, Head of UK Equities at Mirabeau Asset Management. We also have Caroline Escott, Senior Investment Manager, Active Ownership at Relpen, who leads their Global Stewardship Network. Finally, I'm also joined by Janice Turner, who is the founding co-chair of the Association of Member-Nominated Trustees and devised the Red Line Voting, which provides a framework for pension schemes to direct their own stewardship policy. Caroline, we're going to kick off with you. So what does good look like in stewardship? And can you tell us a little bit more about what you're doing around the stewardship code?
Yes, I can. So in terms of what good looks like for us in stewardship, I think it really needs to be what I call the three M's, which is material, meaningful, and measurable. So by material, I mean stewardship has to focus on those issues which are the most impactful for your portfolio. They could be system-wide issues like climate change, issues which affect more sectors in more particularly than others, or they could be stock-specific issues. So as a trustee, you need to have a clear understanding of where your biggest portfolio allocations are, which sectors, which jurisdictions, and what your biggest holdings are, and then think about stewardship as it pertains to those particularly material ESG risks and opportunities. By meaningful, I mean that when it comes to thinking about the broad array of stewardship tools that are available, you have engagement, you have voting, you have escalation tactics like asking questions at AGM, and you've got public policy. You want to make sure that whatever you or your managers are doing makes sense. There is a rationale for them choosing to pursue a particular stewardship approach or use a particular stewardship tool. And then by measurable, I mean that there has to be some way where you can gauge progress and where you can gauge the progress that your managers are making on your behalf. So you need to have a good understanding of what the engagement objectives are, of what the milestones are as well. And you need to be in a position to be regularly reviewing and monitoring and getting the kind of management information that will help you make a decision as to whether or not your manager is undertaking good and meaningful stewardship on your behalf. In terms of the stewardship code, we are in the middle of drafting our own stewardship code report. We are due to submit it by the end of April. And it requires a bit of resource. We put a lot of work into it. We take it quite seriously. For us, it's an opportunity to showcase to the world the kind of stuff we're doing. And there's also a certain joy in writing it too, because It provides an annual chance for us to take a step back and think about what it is about the RailPen purpose and philosophy and governance that makes our approach to stewardship unique. And it's also an opportunity to reflect on some of the outcomes that we've achieved and where we have made good progress and where we've made less progress and what kind of learnings we can take where we haven't been as successful as we might have hoped we would be. And of course, it's not just us and other asset owners producing our own stewardship reports. We use some external managers, although we run lots of our assets internally. And for those external managers, we find their stewardship reports where they have one publicly available and where, of course, they are now signatories to the stewardship code because we know that not every asset manager that applied actually made it through both the first and second rounds. We use these reports as an additional source of information and we incorporate that into our review and monitoring process. Before each meeting that we have with an external manager, we look at their latest stewardship report. We think about what it means and what it says in terms of their alignment with our stewardship priorities. We think about whether there are any gaps that we need to probe on and any issues of concern as well. So the stewardship report is something that we do ourselves, but we also find it a really helpful tool for holding our managers to account and engaging with them.
So Janice, is there anything you'd like to sort of touch on in respect to the stewardship code?
There is one particular issue that we consider to be quite an issue, and that is the part, there's a part of Principle 6 of the Stewardship Code where it says that asset managers should explain how assets have been managed in alignment with client stewardship and investment policies. This is the clear expectation that fund managers should start to act in accordance with their client stewardship policies. Elsewhere in the code, it lets them explain where they haven't managed assets in alignment with their client stewardship and investment policies and the reason for this. But the thing is, in the experience of quite a lot of trustees, this is one area where not enough is being done by the Financial Reporting Council to make this expectation a reality.
So, David, you're the lone asset manager today. So your response to Jan's comments there?
I think that it's imperative that portfolio managers and trustees are aligned in objectives of what we're trying to achieve. It's imperative that we are clear about what we're doing, why we're doing it, how we're voting, why we're voting that way. I'm a passionate believer in that a key sort of principle of responsible investment is that whoever is responsible for the investment decisions has to carry the can, has to be responsible for the governance, because I think too often they can be separated. And so you have stewardship decisions and being taken not by the portfolio managers who are responsible for the investments, but by some of their colleagues who may or may not have the same expertise on the individual businesses. I think it's really important that the portfolio managers carry responsibility, because we have to be responsible to the trustees, to the clients. We have to go and see them, explain what we've done and why we've done it. We have to be open to being grilled about it. And that transparency and collaboration, I think ultimately we've all got the same objectives. And if you get that right, it's a really constructive relationship.
So, Janice, back to you, and something I know you're very passionate about. How important do you think is it for pension schemes to set their own voting policies? And in the same sort of terms, you know, I'm interested to hear a little bit more about the red line voting.
Well, AMNT believes that it's extremely important that pension schemes do set their own voting policies for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's now clearly expected of us by government and regulator. And secondly, it's the only way, really, that you can really fulfil your new responsibilities in holding your fund managers to account. A voting policy sets out how the trustee board believes how the companies it invests in should be run, and it covers the range of environmental, social and governance issues. You need to set this out because a badly run company will very likely lose your members' money in the short or long term. And you mentioned red line voting. So the AMNT developed the red line several years ago after the shareholder spring of 2012, when a lot of trustees wanted to cast their shareholder votes against fat cat pay. We were shocked when the fund managers told us we had no say in how the vote was cast because we invested in pooled funds. And at any rate, there was no demand for trustees to direct their voting. But if there was demand, they said, they would respond. At the time, there was no comprehensive free-to-use voting policy that trustees could use. There was no policy that covered climate change, for example, or many other issues of concern. So we consulted extremely widely in the pensions and financial services industry, for example, with fund managers, with proxy voting companies, investment consultants, and, of course, trustees. We consulted climate experts like the CDP, the Carbon Disclosure Project. And as a result of all that consultation, we developed the Red Lines. It's a comprehensive voting policy covering the range of ESG issues based on the United Nations Global Compact and the UK Corporate Governance Code. And we found that it is actually more progressive than many, in fact, probably most fund managers' voting policies. We call our voting policy the Red Lines because they're set out as red lines that companies shouldn't cross, and they set out how the votes should be cast at an AGM if the company's in breach of them. We do not expect fund managers to follow them blindly. We expect fund managers to engage with companies on this basis and then use their knowledge and expertise to decide how to vote. They are free to vote contrary to the red lines, but we expect them to explain to us why they did so. One of our voting guidelines is to vote against the re-election of the appropriate director at the AGM of companies that are failing on climate change. You'd be surprised how many fund managers claim to care deeply about climate change, but either don't set out how they would vote at all on climate change, or merely say that they would support shareholder resolutions that have been proposed on climate change. In AM&T's study of fund managers' voting policies on climate change, out of only 18 out of the 30 fund managers whose policies we examined had a voting guideline that they published on climate change, and seven of them only had a voting guideline on shareholder resolutions. Since nearly all companies don't have shareholder resolutions proposed at their AGMs on climate change, the fund manager with that policy is effectively saying that they mostly aren't going to vote at all with regard to climate change.
David, do you agree with everything that Janice is saying here?
I agree with all of it. It's exactly what I think portfolio managers should want. It's clear guidelines on what's expected of us. I'm going to, unsurprisingly, push back on the suggestion that portfolio manager has no say. I think that there needs to be input both ways, because I would hope it's always important that the portfolio managers have detailed expert knowledge of the businesses they're investing in. And therefore, we should have a detailed and expert view on many of these issues. And that's something that we should be responsible for. But having clear guidelines and expectations of what we should be doing, absolutely.
And Caroline, I'm going to throw this out to you. So what are your thoughts in respect of voting in pooled funds and the red line voting?
So, you know, I'd said previously that Railpen manages most of its assets internally, and where we use external managers, we often have segregated mandates where we always hold and negotiate the right to exercise the voting decisions ourselves. To David's point, where we do that, whilst we will often be engaging directly with some of the same companies as our asset managers, but where we do that, we also encourage the asset managers to feed through any particularly useful or relevant intelligence from their engagements that they think might be helpful to us in advance of us making the voting decision. And back to Janice's point about the task force and voting in pooled funds, we at Railpen do have investments in a passive pooled vehicle with an external manager. And we have negotiated the voting rights over the UK holdings within that. So it is possible for managers to do it. I recognise that we're lucky at Railpen, what we're, I think, one of the top five largest pension schemes in the UK and significant assets under management, and we can use that leverage accordingly. But it is possible. It is technically possible. And we chose the UK holdings, by the way, because we are a UK pension scheme, because we have significant allocations to the UK as well as North America across our portfolio. So for us, it was particularly important that we exercise those voting decisions and implement the voting decision ourselves.
Let's just touch on engagement now, which I think what we'd like to hear from you, David, on, do you think trustees should engage or disinvest?
Both. So I think there are two aspects. So on the disinvestment, I mean, it's been reasonably well documented that some of the issues that get created by disinvestment aren't necessarily getting us to where we want to get to. But to my mind, there's sort of a few reasons why you could consider disinvestment. One is you've got a business activity which is so misaligned with your objectives as trustees, as investors, that you shouldn't be there anyway. And in some instances, that's climate-related. In other instances, there are other matters at hand. There is then the question of sort of governance and control. So if you're persistently trying to engage to change behaviours, to change what a company's doing, and it's making no progress, you've got a governance problem, because as the shareholders, you're in the business. And if you can't, as an owner, change what the business is doing, then you probably need to go and take your money away, because that's bringing with it fundamental investment risk if you lack that governance control. And the third reason, which is the one we run into most frequently, is you disinvest because it's just a bad investment. And I think one of the challenges that we need to think about with this question of engagement is that, yes, engagement is right. Yes, it's the right thing to do. But you need to be very mindful that you could be engaging to improve the long-term outcome of this business, to do the right thing, but it's still a bad investment. And that's something that we're particularly cautious of.
And Caroline, what's your view on engagement versus disinvestment? And what guidance can you give to trustees?
I think on this, I am in violent agreement with what David said, and it's a bit of both. In our net zero roadmap, we follow the Paris Aligned Investment Initiative's guidance. We committed to net zero by 2050 or sooner, and that's through decarbonising and also through investing in climate solutions. And when we think about decarbonising our portfolio, the easiest, quickest thing to do would be to divest from those 70 or so holdings that constitute the majority of our emissions across the portfolio. We do have some exclusions, by the way, for those companies, the kinds of companies that David was talking about in terms of fundamentally their business model. You know, thermal coal, for instance, is just, or if they're heavily exposed to thermal coal, it's just bad in terms of climate change. So we do already have some fundamental exclusions. But when it comes to those companies we are still invested in, we want to decarbonise, but we want to have real-world impact. And the way in which you do that is to engage with and use your vote in an appropriate fashion and think about public policy measures as well to influence corporate behaviour at that company for the better and to support them in adapting their business model, sometimes quite significantly, to minimise the carbon emissions as much as you possibly can. I think in terms of advice for trustees, I know that there are many trustees who feel external pressure from members writing in to ask for fossil fuel divestment. And it's important, obviously, that we pay attention to what the members think and feel on these issues. We have recently undertaken a member engagement initiative at Railpen on sustainable ownership issues specifically. And one of our findings was that if you talk to members and take them on a journey around decarbonisation and climate change and what investment is and what responsible investment is, and then into the divestment versus engagement debate, they start understanding that pension schemes, investors, can be a real power for good, a real force for good, and they become more relaxed about not divesting immediately. And they understand that engagement, where it is, as I said, material, meaningful and measurable, can have that real world impact to get us onto a Paris-aligned trajectory that we all want to see.
You touched on member engagement there. Tell us about some of the initiatives that Railpen has undertaken to actually engage with its members.
Generally, we think that member engagement and speaking to your members and hearing from them about sustainable ownership can be very powerful in making their savings feel real to them. And there's an emerging body of evidence that shows that if you do that, individuals become more engaged with their pensions generally. So that's a good thing. So we've always tried to communicate to them in an accessible way. We've produced standalone responsible investment reports, I think, since around 2017. We also have very good frequent engagement with our trustee boards, with our pension committees, which are sort of sub-trustee boards, which many of our sponsoring employers have. We've set up a new sustainable ownership client forum as well to dig down deeper and have more extensive sustainable ownership conversations with member representatives and member proxies. But last year, we felt like the time was right and we had the resources to go out and speak to the members directly on sustainable ownership issues. And we had a multi-phase approach, which we've just wrapped up. The first phase was publishing a very concise 13-page long standalone sustainable ownership report, focusing on impact using case studies. Shortly after publishing that and disseminating as widely as possible, newsletters on the member portal and everything else for our members, we surveyed our membership. The survey was available on the member website, and we also sent it to some of our more engaged member advisory groups. And we got a really good response, and we asked our members about a few things. We asked them what they thought about the sustainable ownership issues we were focusing on, how they wanted to be communicated with on sustainable ownership, and to what extent were they even aware of our communications and our disclosures on sustainable ownership, because we produce a number of different documents. You know, we mentioned the stewardship report earlier, but there's the implementation statement as well. There'll soon be the TCFD report. Are they reading any of this? If not, why not? How can we make it more engaging? And the final piece was these member roundtables that I spoke about. And there were some interesting findings. So I've mentioned the finding about engagement versus divestment already. We also got an understanding of their top issues, which were fair treatment of the workforce was number one, followed by fair pay and climate change, sort of joint second, and then by biodiversity and protecting the natural environment as well. And the other interesting finding for us was that even though in that member survey, governance issues didn't come particularly high up, I think they were sixth or seventh, when you had, again, the in-depth conversations with particular members during the roundtable, governance and making sure that you are investing in well-run companies that have expert diverse boards that are supported by the right kinds of systems and processes and have robust internal controls. Governance was the most important issue across all the member roundtables that we held, which was an interesting finding for us. It might not be the most attention-grabbing issue in a survey, but it was worthwhile for many reasons. But also worthwhile to have those member roundtables to dig a little bit deeper. And when you take members on a journey, you get some really interesting results.
So thank you very much. And finally, I'm going to ask Janice and Caroline for their key prediction or their wish for the future relating to climate change. David was very cheeky in the last podcast and gave two. I'm not encouraging that, but if you do, I'm more than happy that you share. Caroline, let's start with you.
Thank you. I'll try to stick with just one. And for me, I think my biggest wish is that companies become better at climate accounting. And it's dry, but it is important. At the moment, you have a lot of companies making these very fancy, sometimes genuinely wonderful climate change commitments and outlining the steps that they will take to ensure that their business models adapt accordingly. However, quite often you're looking at the annual report and you see these climate change commitments in the front end, and then you look at the back end, and even though the company has said that climate change is a material risk, which is why they're undertaking these activities, there is no mention of it anywhere in the financial accounts. And that's a problem, because we know that, quite rightly, when company executives are thinking about their capital allocation expenditure decisions, they are looking at these accounts. And if those accounts do not appropriately reflect the impact of climate change on the business model or the steps that they are going to take, then essentially, and there's this wonderful phrase that was used in, I believe, an IGCC and Carbon Tracker report, then essentially these executives are flying blind. And this is a mythical set of accounts that they have produced. Now, when we speak to companies about this, they will say, oh, well, it's not clear to us how we do it. But in fact, both the auditor's sort of regulator and the company's regulator are clear that where climate change is a material risk, there is nothing to stop auditors and companies and companies' audit codes from considering how they incorporate it into their accounts. So that would be my wish, that that part of the audit profession and the audit codes begin to take real measurable steps towards explicitly considering climate change in their accounts And that's information that investors really need to understand whether or not a company is taking climate change seriously.
Thank you, Caroline. And David's nodding away, so he might steal that as his third wish if we're not careful. So quickly over to Janice before he jumps in.
I think that my wish would be that every single pension scheme, if it hasn't got a voting policy, that it adopts one. I think it's really important that everybody does that. And you don't have to spend thousands on getting a custom policy, because as you know, the AMNT's red lines and the PLSA's policy are there and downloadable. So you have a choice of policies. You can do it how you like, but the most important thing is that you have one. But my prediction is that trustees will win the right to set their voting policies on ESG, including climate change, in pooled funds. And ultimately, they are going to have to be respected by fund managers.
You've been listening to the CACEIS Climate Briefing. I'm Pat Sharman. Goodbye.